Welcome back to the Imagination Redeemed podcast. I'm Brian Brown. In our last episode, I read some reflections from Peter Lighthart on the creative aspects of being made in the image of God. It brought back some memories for me. One of Anselm's earliest lectures back in 2015 was from the spellbinding Malcolm Gait. If you don't know Malcolm, he visited us from Cambridge University, where he researches and writes about theology and literature. Among other things, he is an Anglican priest, a rock band musician, a teacher, a motorcycle enthusiast, and a world-class poet. His collections of sonnets are absolutely stunning for even the novice poetry fan. He also smokes pipes. I'm pretty sure he imports directly from Hobbiton. I wanted to share Malcolm's talk with you because its topic was incarnation and imagination, the relationship between our embodied existence, Christ's sharing of it, and our creativity. He takes us on an energetic ride through Shakespeare's sonnets and plays, his own poetry, and ultimately the prologue to the Gospel of John, exploring how the Word made flesh is the spark at the core of the best Christian creativity. Here is Malcolm Gait. I want you to pay attention to the first few minutes of his talk as well, because he actually does one of the best jobs I have heard explaining why the Anselm Society has the name that it does.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here to drop in, as Clay says. I'm glad we dropped quite gently, but it's lovely to be here. And I'm delighted to discover that here in these beautiful high mountains there is an Anselm Society. Anselm is a really important, highly significant figure. I mean, he's the author of perhaps the best Latin book title ever, which is Cur Deus Homo, which, when you put it into English, means why was God man? Now, talk about a sharp question in words of one syllable. Why was God man? That's Anselm's main book. And in a sense, that's why we need a renaissance of the Christian imagination, why we need to understand about what it is to be embodied, to be bodied forth, if we're even going to begin to come to that mystery that God beyond all things, God utterly transcendent, God of whom we in this tiny corner of the cosmos could have no conception, chooses out of sheer love to be us, to be one of us. Cur Deus Homo, why was God man? Now, Anselm's other great claim to fame is the best definition of theology ever, a definition of theology which, sadly, academic theologians keep forgetting and have to be reminded of, and that's the story of their being reminded of. It is partly why I'm here. So Anselm's definition of theology, again, I'll give you his Latin and then the translation, is fides quaerens intellectum. That means fides, faith, quaerens, seeking, intellectum, understanding. It's really important to have it in that order. He said theology is faith, seeking, understanding. In fact, he was riffing on St. Augustine, who said, credo ut intelligam, I believe in order to understand. Not that my puny understanding and such attempts as I have to use rational powers are ever by themselves going to get me to some conclusion in which my mind, small as it is, can comprehend the wholeness of God's mystery and arrive at a fully orthodox conclusion by a chain of reasoning. That will never happen, because God is always greater, because a mystery is something about which the last word can never be said. As a Franciscan friar who converted me to Christianity once said to me, he said, Malcolm, a mystery is something about which the last word can never be said. And then he said, that's not a challenge. But I have been making up for lost time, you know, ever since. What Anselm was saying was that, of course, by reason alone, and cannot, in its plodding steps, get us to a reliable truth of who God is. The only way we can know who God is and how God is and what he does with us is if he should choose to reveal it to us, which he has done, thanks be to God, by becoming man. Now, when he's done that, we accept that, We accept the gift of that by faith. But does that mean our reason has gone out the window? Does that mean we have no way of thinking that through? On the contrary, now, having that faith, we can begin to use our reason and say, if this is the case, if it is the case that there is a God, then the universe must cohere and make some sense. If he's revealed as a logos in whom all things are, then it might be worth doing some science and finding out what the actual coherence of things is. And historically, it's demonstrable that the development of science in Western society is a direct result of a theological insight, a point of faith, that the world is coherent. Obviously, if you take a different view and you think there is no world, or it's entirely generated by your mind, or it's an illusion, or that the phenomena are the kind of play of Maya or magic, your dream, you don't bother to investigate it because it's not consistently there. But if you think that it is, there is one for whom it is made, through whom it is made, in whom it all coheres and holds together, then you have a basis for using your reason. So, fides quaerens intellectum. That's great. Anselm. The question then is, what kind of intellectum has to do the inquiring? How do we do that? And one of the things that I think is really unfortunate, and that's really what I want to explore with you this evening, is the way in which we've divided up our intellectual capacities into all kinds of different categories. And we've got reason over here, and we've got imagination over here. And we've got this division that says we have an objective set of facts over here that the reason deals with, and we have a subjective set of values or qualities over here which the imagination might apprehend. As, well, what God hath joined, let no man put asunder. He made us with both reason and imagination. He made a world which is physically real and has a solid truth about it and historicity. And he also made it full of image and living symbol. And he made the heavens as they are and the stars in all their glory with all their exact beauty and the wonderful science we can begin to understand how they shine and how they're these living balls of glorious and expanding fire and energy. But he also tells us that the heavens declare the glory of the Lord, and the firmament showeth forth his handiwork, night unto night, unto night uttereth speech. We've mistaken the scientific statements divorced from faith that we can make about the star itself for the total truth about the star, and forgotten the faith that led us to investigate the star in the first place, which was the faith that the star not only was something, but had something to say. How beautifully C.S. Lewis got that in that nice little conversation at the end of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, when they land on Romandu's island and they discover that Romandu is himself somebody who has been a star in the Narnian world and has trod the great dance and circled the heavens and proclaimed the greatness of Aslan. And the others, you know, Caspian and Lucy are all in sort of war and say, oh my goodness, you used to be a star in the cosmos. I was literally starstruck. And Eustace, who is trying to be clever about it, says to Romandu, wow, he says, in our world, a star is just a big ball of flaming gas expanding forever in the cold vacuity of space, or words to that effect. And Romandu leans over to Eustace and says, even in your world, my son, that is not what a star is. It's just what a star is made of. Isn't that an interesting distinction? So we need the imagination to understand what it is. We can use a certain amount of reason to discover what it's made of. We certainly need imagination to understand what it means. C.S. Lewis said, reason is the natural organ of truth. Imagination is the organ of meaning. Have you experienced what it is to live in a world where you can have a series of truths that don't appear to mean anything, and a series of supposed meanings woven for you by the spell makers of Hollywood, which don't appear to have any truth in them? It'd be quite nice to have truth and meaning come back together again sometime. And that's what a renaissance of the Christian imagination might be about. So, sorry, that wasn't what I meant to say. That was just a little preamble to say, hey, Anselm is cool. I like Colorado. Thank you for having me. We'll summon that up. So, some years ago, I became involved in a program in Cambridge to try as a movement, almost a countercultural movement within Cambridge academia, to try and bring theology back to some sort of serious engagement with faith and imagination, so that it didn't just become this dry academic abstract process where we kind of reiterated various theories about the original pericopes of the first form criticisms of it, you know, and you just lost in words. And what was that all about? We're trying to get it back. So my friend and colleague, Jerry Begbie, got a movement going, which I was part of, called Theology Through the Arts. Not theology over here and the arts over here. Not, emphatically not, the arts as a substitute for theology, where people say, well, I've despair of faith, I'm not sure I really believe it anyway, but, you know, let's go to a movie and talk about that. No, but Theology Through the Arts. The conviction that if theology, if Christian theology is true, if that fides, that gift, is essentially true, then it will illuminate and in turn be illuminated by all the arts, all the sciences. The truth with which we have to do is not a private lifestyle option. It's a claim and a stake to what is the case. And if it is the case that we are made in the image of God, then we expect to find resonances of that image in everybody, even those who don't yet know that they're made in the image of God. If it is the case that Christ is the light who lightens everyone who comes into the world, if all things were made in him and without him was not anything made that was made, then it ought to be the case that whenever we engage with any other human being, no matter what their faith or belief, at a deep level, when we talk about the deepest things of the soul, we should feel stirrings and presentiments and patterns and images and echoes of what we know of Christ Jesus. We should begin to discern patterns of death and resurrection, of incarnation, of beauty, of a communion of persons, if that's the way we're made. And it may be that other people who don't yet know that God was born for them in Nazareth and in Bethlehem and grew up in Nazareth and died for them, nevertheless, are being fed deeply by his image in them, are being intrigued by things which their own life and culture and science can't explain, but which a decent theology might bring into focus. If that's the case, then fearlessly, a Christian theologian can engage fully with the world of the arts, explicitly Christian arts or non-explicitly Christian arts, and say, let me begin my theology here. Let me just sit with this artist as she shapes the clay. Let me be with this painter as he changes the surface and the meaning of the canvas. Let me sit alongside this poet as this poet tells me what it is to body forth meaning in words. And let me ask them to tell me what is the deepest truth of their art and what they're doing. If there is any truth in my theology, as long as I wait patiently, if I wait and see, they will tell me something new about my Jesus, and I will tell them something about who they belong to and where their art has come from, if I listen patiently. That is an act of faith. It's an act of faith that a true theology will find echoes and resonances elsewhere. So, and there's a terrible danger for us if we don't do that. If we're fearful of it, if we say, I'm going to sort of consign the imagination and the arts to kind of the other side, and I'm going to stick to this purely syllogistic reasoning, as though somehow a doctrinal formulation were less likely to become a heartbreaking idol than a beautiful icon. They're both humanly made things. Even the best doctrinal formulation can become a kind of an idol and a tribal shibboleth. C.S. Lewis wrote that amazing poem in Apologist's Evening Prayer, in which he said, from all my lame defeats, but oh much more from all the victories I seem to score on thy behalf, take me from all my trumpery, lest I die. Thoughts are but coins. Let me not trust instead of thee their thin-worn image of thy head. O thou fair silence, fall and set me free. He always knew there was a deeper mystery beyond anything he could say, and he didn't want to fall in love with his own formulations. But I think if we look back across the history of church, we can see time and again we have fallen in love with our own formulations, and we haven't allowed our imaginations to be baptized and renewed by God. So let me quote you some lines from a brilliant Scottish poet, 20th century Scottish mystical poet, who nearly lost, well, he did lose his faith, and then he recovered it. He was brought up in a very strongly Calvinist kirk in Scotland, in a church completely purged of all images, just the bare white walls, with a very, very strong doctrinal base and a kind of haranguing kind of preaching. Now, for some people, maybe that worked, but he was a gifted, sensitive child who thought through image and intuition. And he just felt everything gift he had was just dismissed or seemed to be somehow, you know, corrupted and fallen. So he left, and it was a time of great poverty. He was in the 30s. He saw the church doing nothing about social justice. He looked for the people who were. He became a communist. He became an active communist working among the working classes in Glasgow until he realized that the communism, almost exactly like the Calvinism of his time, had no time for the heart, for the imagination, for the soul, for love. That it saw, if Calvinism saw man as an utterly depraved creature who could only be saved by saying the right theological formula, then communism saw man as an economic animal, whose only meaning was in who owned the means of production. So he rejected that, and thanks be to God, he came back to faith. And when he looked back, he wrote this about what church was like for him as a child. And I just think this is a standing warning to churches, and it's about why we need to do what we're doing tonight. So this is what Edwin Muir said. He said about church: the Word made flesh is here made words again. The Word made word in flourish an arrogant crook. See there? King Calvin with his iron pen, and God, three angry letters in a book. This better gospel in man's natural tongue. And truer sight was theirs who in ignorant wonder saw the cross tree on the bare hillside, not knowing that a God there suffered and died. How could our race betray and the incarnate one unmake who chose this form and fashion for our sake? So it's a poem called The Incarnate One, and it's about the need to be incarnate again, for the Word made flesh to be allowed to be flesh. Still gloriously and lucidly the Word. And I think the point he's making there is not a specific one about Calvin. It happened to be Calvin. It's not that there aren't great, great things from which you can live and be deeply nurtured in the Christian institutes. It's about whether we allow God to be incarnate. So let me, in the time remains, in this preamble, I want to have a go at doing what I said we should do, doing theology through the arts. I want to do this thing and say, I'm fides querens intellectum, I'm faith-seeking understanding. I know what my faith is. If I'm going to seek some understanding of it, let me for a moment hold it there, leave it, as it were, shining beautifully at the door of an artist's studio or a poet's writing hut, and let me go in and sit with them and see what they say about what they're doing. And then let me see if what they say about what they're doing actually illuminates my faith, or my faith illuminates what they're doing and gives them some rooting and grounding for the practice of their art. So the art I love most is poetry, and since we're going to try and sit beside a poet and think about what they do, let's go to the best, and let's ask William Shakespeare if he can help us think about what exactly is going on when a poet makes poetry. So I've got a handout here with a passage from one of Shakespeare's earlier and most beautiful plays, of the wonderfully playful A Midsummer Night's Dream. Now, you wouldn't expect there to be anything necessarily illuminating to the Christian faith here, because after all, A Midsummer Night's Dream is set in pre-Christian Athens. Although it's a very strange Athens, we have the rational daylit court of Duke Theseus and his fiancée Hippolyta getting ready for their wedding. But curiously enough, strangely, just behind the Parthenon and the Acropolis, just up in a little hillside the other side, is a magical English woodland, moonlit and enchanted with Puck and Oberon and Titania. So there's a very much a movement between an imaginative, moon-drenched, transformative magical woodland and a set of clear ideas about what should or shouldn't be done that take place in the judgments of the courts of Athens. We kind of move back and forth between those two. Now, I don't know if you how well you know this play or if you know it at all. I'd hate to do a plot spoiler here, but just in order to get into what we're about to hear, I need to give you just a little bit of a plot summary. Now, essentially, the play opens with Theseus and Hippolyta longing for their wedding day and waiting for the day to come. And then we get a problem. Somebody comes to appeal to the Duke because a father who wants his daughter to marry one person and she won't marry that person because she's in love with another person, but that other person is in love with somebody else. And essentially, you just have two couples who are completely out of sorts, and it's the classic kind of, I love her, but she hates me, but, you know, she loves the person who loves me, but I don't like them. And, you know, as they say on Facebook, it's complicated. You know, and so they make various plans to elope and go off into these magical woods, which they don't know are magical woods, and they overhear each other, and they all end up going off quite near the beginning of the play. And then, in the play, they meet these two characters where we become aware that there are two other characters, Oberon and Titania, who have quarrelled, and that they need to be reconciled. And there's a kind of tension of dislocation going on. But there's a kind of very playful character called Puck, who has a series of almost practical jokes. But actually, if only he could start a clinic in California, he could do therapy, Puck. Because actually what he does through this series of practical jokes is to get them to try out almost in a role play, almost every possible combination of who loves who. But by the end of this strange dreamlike night with its love potions and its chase scenes and its magical transformations, by the end, these lovers return to the court, return to the daylight Athenian scene, completely well-matched and sorted. Their stuff is worked through. They are ready to get married. And the play ends with a delightful and beautiful celebration of generative, warm, steadfast covenant love in marriage, which is blessed even by Oberon and Titania, who are also reconciled. And that's how the whole play ends. Now, the bit I've given you is where we've seen all the action taking place, but Theseus and Hippolyta, who've been in Athens all the time, have been like off stage. They didn't see it happen. And clearly what's just happened at the end of Act 4, which is the beginning of Act 5, is that all of the other characters, Helena and Hermione and Demetrius, all these young lovers, have come back and told them, wow, you won't believe what happened to us. It was like totally amazing, you know. There was this fairy queen and this fairy king, and there's this little puck guy, and we did, you know. And so Theseus is a sort of bluff, you know, pragmatic, practical sort of Englishman of the kind who keeps a shop and doesn't want to have any of this fancy stuff or anything to do with poetry. Although Hippolyta, whom he's getting married to, is a wonderful mythical Amazonian princess. So you know, he's not going to have a quiet life. But so they've just heard this story, right? And their question arises, can they believe it? Can they believe all that strange imaginative stuff that happened, which they didn't see, but they've now heard as a story? And so Hippolytus says, 'Tis strange, my Theseus, that these lovers speak of. And this is the origin of the phrase, more strange than true. Theseus goes, oh, more strange than true. I never may believe these antique fables nor these fairy toys. Lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. Naturally placing himself as the guy with cool reason there, you notice. Oh, the lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold, that is the madman. The lover all as frantic sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. He's dismissing them, isn't he? He says, oh, you don't want to believe this stuff. Quite funny, actually, when you think about it. Like, he's saying, I never may believe these antique fables. Wait a minute, you are Theseus. You are an antique fable. Nor these fairy toys. Well, we discover later in the plot that the reason why Titania, the fairy queen, is there is that when Theseus was a young man, she led him through the glimmering wood. She has unfinished business with Theseus and has come to bless the bed of her former lover. But he's forgotten all about that. You know, he's taken revenge on and forgotten his earlier romantic understandings. But she's just saying, oh, wait a minute, you used to see visions too. You used to dream dreams. Even now you think you're a very practical, sensible businessman who doesn't do that kind of thing. So I never may believe these antique fables nor these fairy toys. And then he finally goes on, as we'll see in a minute, to attempt to say, and another thing, poets always make stuff up. You don't want to believe poets. There's nothing in poetry. Except that he says it in poetry. He says it in the most beautiful poetry imaginable. Every single line that he speaks is a perfectly balanced and beautifully metered line of iambic pentameter, rich with assonance, beautiful, melodic, poetry of a kind that only Shakespeare would produce. And so Shakespeare's having a bit of fun here, isn't he? He's actually giving to the character who doesn't believe in poetry almost the best poetry in the play. And then, in the very speech in which the character who says he doesn't believe this kind of thing says he doesn't believe this kind of thing. In that very speech, Shakespeare, I haven't read it yet, I've paused at the moment, I've kind of pressed pause on Shakespeare here. Shakespeare suddenly, you know, you notice the lover and the madman, they get half a line each, right, yeah? The lunatic lover and the poet of imagination compact. Well, the lover, the madman sees more devils. The lover sees Helen's beauty in the brow of Egypt. They get little dismissal. If it was being symmetrical, the poet would get like one line and you're out. Whoa. Here's what he says about the poet. And this is what I want to, this is where I want to begin to do some theology through the art of poetry. Here's what he says about the poet. The poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. That's not a bad account of what happens in poetry from someone who claims he doesn't believe in it. And you can see what Shakespeare's done. I mean, he's suddenly opened up a window in his poem and, as it were, almost stepped out from behind Theseus and said, let me tell you what I'm doing here, folks. If you want to understand what's going on in this play, you want to understand my whole art, you want to understand why coming to a play written in poetry is worth doing, it's all here. And he's doing it deliciously, kind of at the expense of one of his own characters. Because, of course, Theseus is very busily sawing off the branch he's sitting on, you know. It's kind of antique fable, you know, fairy toy poetry, whoops, you know. It's kind of. So I just wanted to give you that context. And, of course, so he goes on to say, you know, you don't want to believe this. Such tricks hath strong imagination that if it would but apprehend some joy, it comprehends some bringer of that joy. Hippolyta replies, but all the story of the night told over, and all their minds, that's the minds of the people who've been off stage having all these adventures, all their minds transfigured so together, more witnesseth than fancy's images, and grows to something of great constancy, but howsoever strange, and admirable. So we're back to strange my Theseus. And she's saying, well, wait a minute, you know, let's just look at the practical results. You know, you're a practical man, Theseus. You like to see the evidence and weigh it up and, you know, scientific guy. If nothing happened in the magical woods, how come these people who were ready to kill each other and sue each other and run away from home and refuse to get married have now come back able to live a harmonious and fruit? How is it that they've been transfigured? How is it that the story they tell lives and grows to something of great constancy? You know, let's look at what the fruits are. So even though ostensibly the whole Theseus speech is against imagination, in fact, it contains the greatest case for it. And in fact, I think Shakespeare lets us in right to the heart of his own workshop and how it is that he makes poetry. So I want to go back just to the middle bit now. I just want to look at those lines from the poet's eye, Dante name. Let me read it again. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Let's just think about this as an account of how poetry works, but I think we can extend it a little bit, since it's about imagination, to almost all the arts, and some of you may be fans of and practitioners of other art forms that are beyond poetry. I'll concentrate on poetry because that's the art form I practice. But so let's begin with what it says. The poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. So that sets up a field of operation, doesn't it? And it just puts us in mind very strongly of a kind of vertical axis. It brings in heaven and earth, and it repeats them twice. Heaven to earth, earth to heaven. It takes two things that we want to separate. Here we are on the earthly things, the heavenly is different. Just like, as you'll see, we've got a constant separation here between imagination and reason. So, the poet is concerned with both. It's a both and, not an either or. Heaven to earth, earth to heaven. And we have a kind of tension there. How can they bring those two things together? Well, the answer is by means of imagination. Imagination, as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Now, just to lift our eyes from Shakespeare for a minute and think about the arts now. Think a little bit about arts as we understand them, whether it's kind of high art thing in like abstract art, abstract expressionism in modern galleries, or whether it's novels or poems, or going to a gallery you love and seeing paintings you really love. Just thinking about your own response to art. Think about it in terms of that axis between heaven and earth. If for the moment we think about heaven, you know, we talk about the creation of all things visible and invisible. Did you notice that contrast between imagination apprehends more than cool reason ever comprehends, yeah? You might think earth, visible, comprehend in one part of one end of a pole, right? That there are things you can comprehend, literally means to get your mind around something, doesn't it? Yeah? Surround it, you know? So the things you can really get your mind around, the things of the earth, you know exactly what that is, you've got it totally sussed. And you've got an image for it, you know what it is. Then you might think heaven apprehend invisible as that right up there in another realm. I just got a fleeting glimpse of it. I don't quite know what it is. It's there and then it's not there. It's like T.S. Eliot said, poetry's peripheral vision. You know, it's there, and you kind of, as soon as you go to look at it, it's gone. So you have to learn to be very still until the thing you saw in the peripheral vision just gradually comes, you know, to the center. That's what poetry allows you to do. The trouble is, we need to connect them. Now, think about works of art. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rung, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, two different trajectories along the same axis, yeah? And you can see different writers, different poets, different artists, whose predilection is to start at either end. You can see artists and painters and poets and filmmakers who start at the heavenly end of the axis, and they've got this kind of total, you know, intuitive concept. They know this kind of little linked moment, lightning apprehension thing, and they're constantly going around the earth looking for things to body it forth with, looking for images, trying to find that connection, trying to find something that they can take that thing they already half know and finally illustrate it, right? So they start from heaven and they go down to earth. And if it's good art, they find some fantastic image or series of images that really does body it forth. And as it were, the kind of unembodied lightning of potential meaning that's been quivering around in the back of their minds and the back of your mind for so long, suddenly, like a kind of lightning conductor, leaps down and shines out at you because they finally made the connection and found the image, yeah? Now, you can see other artists who start at the other end, and they love the earth, and they're things earthly, and they like getting their hands dirty with the clay, and they're the kind of painters who think that the paint itself is just fantastic, and they love the thickness of it, and the kind of texture of it, and they're working, you know, they go out and grind their own paints and mix their own vegetable dyes, and they do all that, and you get, you know, poets who just love the sound of the words and almost fall in love with the sound of it, there's a sound first, and then you say, I'll figure out what it means later. Just, you know, just let me go with this sound. I just love it. And, you know, guitarists who even before they've started playing are just wanting to tell you about exactly what wood this was made of and, you know, care deeply about what brand of strings they've got and everything. You know, they start there. But even as they begin to love that bit of earth and comprehend it, the glance goes from earth to heaven. And somehow this beautiful thing opens out. And they make that earthly space or shape so beautiful and habitable that those kind of flitting apprehensions just can't help but come in and be manifest through them. Okay? And you can see different poems working that way. One of the greatest kind of modern poems, I think, by the late, great Seamus Heaney is a poem called Digging. And it starts with the most kind of visceral image, and it starts between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. So he's sitting trying to write. And then he hears this scraping sound of a spade below the window. And he looks out and he has this fantastic description of his father digging potatoes. And you know, and then he remembers how they used to dig potatoes and he loved the cool feel of the potatoes in his hands. And he gives you the sounds of the coarse slap and squelch of the spade going through the mud. And then he remembers his grandfather digging. It's all about digging. And then just perfect description of all the different kinds of turf, all the different kinds of spades, the way you could go in, the way you could open things up, the way you brought warmth and light to others. But it all is just think, oh, it's a poem about digging. And then last little two lines of the poem, he says, or last few lines, he says, but I have no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it. And as soon as he goes, like, I'll dig with it, every single one of those totally earthy images of digging has opened out and become the emblem of a meaning about what it is to write, what writing is all about, okay? So Heaney is of the earth and starts there, but he reaches always, if you like, to the heaven of a meaning, okay? Now, you can see that's the way artists work. You can also see art failing to be what it is and not delivering the goods because it doesn't go from earth to heaven or earth to heaven. It just stays in the place where it is. You can see art and poetry, particularly some modern poetry, is very guilty of this, which is so up in the world of, you know, my own private, weird little private language and my personal things and my deep obscurity and my peculiar view of life. And I'm not going to make a single concession to you. I'm not going to give you one single image you can think with. I'm going to write poetry that practically puts you off. And you can see art and music doing the same thing. And who knows? There may, for that privately, for that artist, there may have been some moment of unembodied heavenly apprehension. But it was never bodied forth. It was never touched the earth. And it's therefore no earthly use. You know, you just can't do anything with it. And, you know, you can pretend you understood what it meant. But, I mean, you know, and, like, hang out with the other cool people at the gallery. But really? You know? At least it confesses what it is when it calls itself abstract expressionism. Though, in fact, sometimes I think it's more abstract than expression, you know. If it was expression, then you'd get something. Anyway, but equally, you can see art and poetry and sculpture failing totally at the other end, where somebody writes a poem that is so obvious, it tells you, you know, I was out in my garden and the birds sang, you know. Really? And what then? It's kind of, do you know what I mean? Where you get it totally. It's like those little, you know, I don't know if you have them here. We have greetings cards, you know, really naff greetings cards with tiny little sort of rinky-dinky cliched poems, which are always written by a woman whose name is Patience Strong. You know. And when you've read it, you've got it. That is it. There is nothing more. You know, you knock on the back of the door of that poem. There is no wardrobe door opening anywhere. You know, you are not going to be ushered into something that is bigger on the inside than the outside. That is it. You know, you've had it. And you can see paintings and pieces of music that do that as well. It's just kind of like bubblegum music, you know, etc. I remember a great interview with Neil Young about the way he said the music industry didn't want people to write stuff that would open up and grow and develop and that you'd keep going back to and get more and more from, because that doesn't sell records, because you keep playing the same old record again and again, getting more and more. So Neil, in a great image, said, what they need now is big bands. And the poor interviewer said, "Big bands? What is a big band?" He thought "big" was maybe some new rhythm of music, you know. But he said, "It's like a big pen. You just, you know, you use one and you throw it away. Use another one and you throw it away." And that's what these big industries wanted to do with so-called creatives and artists. They didn't really want them to be creative. They wanted them to be one-hit wonders. Just do that thing. It's delivered everything it has to deliver on the first listening. You're finished. Deeply destructive, incredibly corrosive of the hopes and dreams of the people that got turned into those big bands, you know, who never got their own artistic integrity because they were manipulated by people who never wanted them to reach up and touch heaven. Well, Shakespeare could have said, he says, look, the poet's eye, the artist's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. It's both and. So, okay, it's both and. Now, the problem is then, how do I put them together? How do I do that? How do I make that connection? That's what Shakespeare's asking. And he answers it. The poet's eye in a fine frenzy rolling doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. So I just want to draw your attention to an amazing thing, which is the way Shakespeare puts the two words imagination on the one hand and bodies on the other, right next to each other. Right next to each other. The technical word we use in the joys of literary criticism is juxtaposition. It's a great word. So it's the juxtaposition of imagination and bodies, and they're from completely different realms. Nobody has ever put these two words together before. You know, imagination is the unreal, the weird, the airy-fairy, the thin, the diaphanous, the made-up, the kind of flitting around in some vague thing, blown away as soon as you wake up. Imagination, right? Bodies is like this lumpen thing, you know. Hamlet says, oh, that this too solid flesh would thaw, resolve itself. You know, this is sweat, this is waking up at night, this is runny noses, you know, this is aches in the bones. This is also beautiful tenderness and kisses and happy, quiet breath fluttering the dark and whispering by candlelight. That's body too. But it's the physical thing. It's rooted in place. Imagination is all over the place. And what does Shakespeare do? He puts imagination and bodies together. It's like, did you ever do that experiment with magnets when you were a kid at school? Like, if you have them, like, one pole one way, they go like that, and they're just, like, locked. But if you turn one of them around, you don't even know, you wouldn't know there was a magnetic, and you start pushing them together, and they don't want to go. But as you hold them, you can feel, it's like the thing is coming alive. You can feel this kind of quivering pulse. Well, mainly the art of poetry consists of so arranging the words in relation to each other that the latent energies and fields of semantic force of awesome meaning, are released by the way you've put them together. And you need a really strong point. If you're going to hold these poles like that, and it generates a current, you know, we generate power by spinning magnets around. There's a kind of amazing energy coming out of this bit of poetry because he's put imagination and bodies together, and he said, you guys are going to have to live together. And there's this incredible thing going on. And the very moving together of imagination and bodies, that connection, is exactly what we're looking for with our problem of heaven and earth, earth and heaven. Apprehend, comprehend. Imagination, bodies. The imagination's job is to make that link and get into the body. And the body's job is to be that hospitable place that the imagination can come into, and also the window opening to the imagination so we can move back and forth from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And what does that bodying do? Well, the poet's pen turns them to shapes. Shape, look at these words. We've got body, shape, form, name. Those are the essential elements of any kind of art. The specificity of it, the being right here, right now. That paradox whereby the more particular you are about that's exactly how much coffee I drank and that's the way the sun fell on the tear-stained letter that I was reading when I couldn't drink my cup anymore. That's what makes it universal. Not, hey, I was vaguely reading this sad letter sometime and, you know, it's, the more specific you are, the more everybody gets it. There's a peculiar thing about bodying forth, that the very bodying makes something universal. You'll recognize that, you know. You know this stuff. This is just essentially about the nature of all imaginative arts. It's not just poetry. And then look at this beautiful thing, a local habitation and a name. It seems to me that there's something remarkable going on here, that there's a kind of hospitality. There's a kind of generosity. There's a kind of welcome in this making of art, that you make a shape that is habitable, that it's a door where it's a shape that the reader or the viewer of the art feels they want to walk. They want to open this door. And it's a shape inside that's welcoming enough that the disembodied apprehensions, the brief intuitions, feel this is a place I could live. I could come into this. There could be a meeting place here. And it's local and it's nameable. So, time is flying by me. So let's say we've been sitting here. We've suspended our belief, right? We've parked for a moment those lucid and beautiful truths by which we live, but which we believe will be manifest in any place that we look at closely enough. And we've sat beside Shakespeare and got him to explain to us what is going on when he makes his art. And he's chosen to put that explanation in the mouth of a pagan Duke Theseus who doesn't believe in poetry, right? Now, I don't know about you, but for me, the more I've dwelt with this passage, the poet's eye glancing from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, this thing about imagination and bodies, this thing about a local habitation and a name, the more it has rung bells for me. I thought, there's something, what is this? There's something going on here. This is just this shape, this pattern, this field of reference, these very words. There's something here. And I don't know how long it took me, but the penny finally dropped. I thought, funny thing William Shakespeare's doing here. Do you know what he's doing? He's riffing on the preface to John's Gospel. That's what he's doing. That's what's going on here. We start off in that wonderful prologue. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was with God in the beginning. In the beginning, all things were made from. And it goes on like that, and you're going, yeah, John, you know, it's great. But you can't put it, there's no picture. There's no image. You know it's true. He was with God. He was in God. It was the same in the beginning. You know, it's up there, and you know it's beyond your reach. You know it's true, but it's utterly, you know, you don't belong there. And then suddenly, as Shakespeare, of course, I hasten to say, would not have read it in the authorised version because it hadn't been written then. It hadn't been made. It was 1611. He had the Geneva Bible, the Dewey Bible, and he had enough Latin for the Vulgate. I think he was drawing from the Vulgate on this. So, et verbum caro factum est, and the Word was made flesh. And what did the Word do when the Word was made flesh? Dwelt among us, lived in our midst. And guess what? The first question of the disciples to Jesus is in John's Gospel when they meet him. It is, Magister, ubi habitas? Master, where is your habitation? Where are you staying? And what does Jesus say? He says the thing that every Christian should say to anybody who asks them about their faith. Not, hey, I've got a great theological formulation for you. they should say, come and see. That's what Jesus says, come and see. And then actually, when you later on, the other disciples are getting more and bringing people in, and they say, oh, come anything good, come out of Nazareth, whatever. He's like, come and see. Come and see. They knew they could see him reliably. They said, we beheld his glory. Glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. We were able to see. Now, I suddenly find, as I've thought about the way this poetry works, that I've been given back, I as a theologian, if you like, and as a Christian, oh, I've got a whole new way of thinking. My goodness. God not only creates the cosmos in that big conceptual way, where you say, let there be light and there is light, but if you think about it, in the second Genesis narrative, you've got, he stoops down and he makes gets his hands dirty with the squidgy clay. We've got both ends there. Then he wants to be in it. He's bodied forth in it. His meaning, all meaning, there is no meaning beyond the Logos. In him, all truth is there. He's bodied forth perfectly and beautifully in the living, walking poem of Jesus Christ, in whom everything eternal is made particular, and who invites everybody to come towards him, not because he's containing and keeping things these away, but because he is a habitation with open doors. So, of course, in John's Gospel, he says, I am the door. What else could he say? Open up, walk in. And then I see how often the poems I love best, not explicitly Christian poems, keep doing this. I think let's just, my favorite poem, probably my single favorite poem, the poem that I read that made me want to be a poet, the poem that I read that said, I don't know what that is, but that's what I want to do, right? John Keats, Ode to a Nightingale. I first read it, I was dragged to Keats's house by an aunt when I was 16, who was one of those improving aunts who, you know, you're on your holiday, you've just come away from school. I want to lie back and watch TV. No, we're going to Keats' house. I don't know who Keats is, some boring old fart. How do I know? You know? Of course, then I get there. I see this passionate young man, you know, that he died. And it so happened the poem was on the wall. And the window was open, the French window door in the house that he knew. And the tree that the nightingale had sung in was there. And I had nothing better to do, you know, so I stood and read this poem. And I was completely, you know, you remember how that begins? It begins on the earth. It begins the most unpromising opening lines of any poem in the English language. My heart aches. And an empty peg pain dulls my sense. As though of hemlock I had drunk. 1 minute passed, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains. 1 minute passed, and leafy words had sunk. Ache, dull, sunk, drains, leafy. It's not a promising start. It's like, I already wouldn't bother to go on. And he's going like, then suddenly he hears the nightingale sing. And you know, thou light winged dryad of the trees in some melodious plot of beech and green and shadows numberless, singest of summer with a full-throated ease. And you remember he goes out into the dark. I cannot tell what flowers are at my feet, nor what soft incense hangs upon the boughs, but in embalmed darkness guess each week. He goes out, and you get this amazing image right at the end of the poem where he's passed through the doors, he's drawn out by the song, and he suddenly, it's like, it's not a logical image, it's not one you can account for in a rational way. Why do I have this image? It just happens. He suddenly says he comes to magic casements opening on perilous seas in fairy lands forlorn. And then he comes back and says, forlorn, the very word is like a bell to toll me back from thee to my soul self. But for you started with my heart ached and an empty dullness pains my sense as though of hemlock. And suddenly you're right on the brink of magical casements and perilous seas. And you know somehow that if you could only stay there, if you could just stay in this poem a little bit longer, the windows would open and you would kind of walk across those perilous seas. And all art is doing that, really good art is doing that, taking you and opening this window and opening this door and kind of beckoning. It has a quality of throughness. It's what makes it what it is. So I began to think, my goodness, maybe the reason why any artist does what they do and needs to do it and wants to blink heaven and earth and heaven, is because we are made in the image of a God who has done that fully and finally forever. Maybe Jesus Christ is really the one in whom and through whom and for whom all things are made, including the poems that are made by poets who don't even know his name. That very attempt to do that, maybe it's not only that made possible because we have that image in us, we're made in the image of our maker, but maybe the big problem, and this is a really serious problem in contemporary literary critical theory and the discourse which is unfortunately known as semiotics, there's a big crisis in the Western universities at the moment about the meaning of meaning and the possibility of communication. And professors are writing long learned terms based on the works of Derrida and Wittgenstein to say that there is never any actual communication, that words don't actually add up to anything, that every decoding is another encoding, that we can't actually ever say anything and know that it's been heard, right?
They use words to do it.
Yeah, and they use words to do it. And they expect you to read their book. Like, if you've written a book saying that books can't tell me anything, why should I read it? Yeah. But anyway, there is a crisis. And the reason why there's a crisis, according to their theory, in which we're unwinding enzymes and knowledge is socially constructed and is the actual kind of mindless outworking of a selfish gene. If that's your fundamental premise, if that is the fides from which you're trying to get your intellectum, you're not going to get a very sensible intellectum. You know, because you can't generate meaning out of meaninglessness. You can't get an ought out of an is. You can't construct any basis of living if you don't have a fundamental basis for making a distinction between a thing and a person. And to make a distinction between a thing and a person, you have to have this thing called meaning. Now, I suddenly realize as I enjoy Shakespeare and then go back to my John's Gospel, that I have right then and there, in the incarnation of Jesus Christ and in the whole frame of Christianity, I have a really profound and beautiful framework that accounts for how art works and why we have meaning and why we want to do it. So my fides, quaerens, and intellectum has suddenly found a real intellectual gem that I can share, actually, in the public square with other people. May not share my faith, but I may say, well, listen, let me just take a model from my faith and show you this thing. Well, let's think about this Logos thing. How does that work? And it's got traction. But it also does something for me personally. What it does is it takes away any fear or mistrust that might have been inculcated in me in some place that, oh, you know, the Theseus, my inner Theseus, you know, oh, you can't trust these artists, these poets, you know, that's a load of junk, you know, it's just, you know, this formulation was good enough. You know, even as Theseus tries to say that, his poetry undermines him. And I think the church needs to recover the courage of its convictions and its foundations. And it is founded by one who is himself artistically embodied meaning. Meaning made visible, meaning made beautiful, meaning made habitable and hospitable and welcoming in the touch of the body and in the physical event, which is then transfigured because it is also a meaningful event, because earth and heaven meet, heaven and earth. And the more I think about this axis, glance from earth to heaven, from heaven to earth, the more I realize there's something else going on. There's another image haunting that Shakespeare thing, which, considering it's A Midsummer Night's Dream, took me, because I'm a bearer of very little brain, a little while longer to get to, but I figured it out. I said, there's something going on here about Jacob's dream. There's something about thinking you're in an ordinary place, and then you have this dream, and then in this supposedly particular local place, the heavens opened, and you see the angels of God ascending and descending down the ladder, and he wakes up and says, why, this is the very gate of heaven. I didn't know it. How awesome is this place, he says, finally giving the English language a word which will be applied in this country only to running shoes. And a nice day. Awesome. But he says, awesome. How awesome is this place? Why, this is the very gate of heaven. And what does he do? I'll tell you what he does. He makes the first ever art installation. He looks around and says, I've got to mark this something. There has to be a physical bodying forth of this moment of the revelation of God. And he takes the very stone that he's had laid his head on, and he shifts it and does this beautiful thing with it and sets it up as Bethel. Yeah? Now, so I thought, oh, that's interesting. There's a Genesis thing going on here. But I think Shakespeare is riffing on John's Gospel. But I think he's got that Genesis thing in there. So I'm carrying on reading my John's Gospel one day. And, of course, I suddenly get to the blindingly obvious thing, which is the hidden I am saying. Oh, there are all so many I am sayings. But do you remember when Nathaniel, who's been thinking, oh, you know, Nazareth, kind of thing good coming from Nazareth, you know, you don't want to believe that stuff, or, you know, it's like Theseus, come and see. So he comes along to see Jesus. And Jesus says, here's a true Israelite. How did you know me? Jesus says, I saw you sitting under the tree. And suddenly, Nathanael totally gets it. He says, you are the Messiah, you are the Son. Jesus says, it's all about seeing back and forth. Do you say this, I say this because I said I saw you? And then if you go in your Greek, he moves from the singular, second person vocative singular to second person vocative plural, looks out at everyone, you, all of you, everyone, you will see greater things than these. And what does he say? He says, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending. And you can imagine Nathanael's going, I know this one. Yeah, you'll see the heavens open to God and ascending and descending on Jacob's ladder. Yeah, yo, you know, my name is Nathanael. That's got L in it. I'm there. You know, he's waiting to do that. But that's not what Jesus says, does it? Do you remember what Jesus says? You will see the heavens open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. What is he saying? He's saying, I am Jacob's ladder. I am Jacob's ladder. Jacob's ladder was a vision of the coming of Christ Jesus, that there would be a connection between heaven and earth, and that connection would always be the very gate of heaven. That's what it was. And so this whole thing that Shakespeare is doing, listen to it again. The poet's eye in a fine frenzy rolling doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. It's all there, the habitation of God. So that's, if you like, a little bit of theology through the arts. We've done some thinking with Shakespeare. We've actually found that this art that's set in a pre-Christian period is just hugely resonant with and friendly to and complementary to our Christian vision, and may even help us to understand it more deeply. So it's on that kind of basis that I would thoroughly encourage you to seeing about a renaissance of the imagination in the Christian church. Now, I've been asked, we'll do some questions and answers in a minute. You'll see some other things on here. I was going to do a whole thing about C.S. Lewis and how reason and imagination were healed in him, but I haven't had a chance to do it. Have to be another occasion. I've also given you one of my own sonnets on there, which is about the implications of that bodying forth for us in our life as church and in the life of sacrament. We've got a lot of old controversies about sacrament and all this stuff, you know, but it's very tiring, you know. We don't have to fight the 16th century battles anymore about what's going on in communion. Somebody once said to me, so in the Holy Eucharist, do you believe in the real presence, Malcolm? And I said, yeah, I believe in it. I just haven't achieved it yet. I know he's present. He's already present always to me at all times. My problem is, how can I be present to him? You know, am I actually paying attention? You know, how am I going to get there? He's always there. But when I begin to think about what it means for imagination to body forth, about the incredible humility and grace with which Jesus, with God himself, you know, the eternal Son, who was in form equal with God, but did not cling to equality with God, he became not just a child, he became that tiny little seed unfolding in the womb, became a thing you couldn't see in a microscope, and took life gradually from Mary. He utterly invested himself into the body in the particular. He was bodied forth in every possible way. And I think all his encounters with us, including those in the bread and the wine, but also in the ones when we meet each other's gazes and in the ones where he comes to us, you know, declaring something, are bodyings forth. So I'll just close with this little poem of mine, just to kind of, since it's there. I was just really moved that this was recently set. We may have a chance to hear it later. This was set just recently by the American composer Jack Redford to choral music, and it's just astonishing what he did with it. But I suppose there's a continuity here. Love's choice. This bread is light, dissolving, almost air, a little visitation on my tongue, a wafer-thin sensation, hardly there. This taste of wine is brief in flavour, flung a moment to the palate's roof and fled, even its aftertaste, a memory. Yet this is how he comes. Through wine and bread, love chooses to be emptied into me. He does not come in unimagined light, too bright to be denied, too absolute for consciousness, too strong for sight, leaving the seer blind, the poet mute. Chooses, instead, to seep into each sense, to dye himself into experience. I'll pause there. Thank you for listening for so long.